when too many workers are barely getting by? Should they be paying for the union boss to get rich?
Well, welcome all you wiretappers out there. Another episode here of Gangland Wire. I'm in the studio. As you can see behind me, we've got our friend from Chicago, Camulus Cam Robinson. Welcome, Cam.
Hey, Gary. Glad to be here as usual.
Well, you know, I haven't talked to you for a little bit, but we'll get something going today, won't we?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Work's been a little bit crazy, but I'm glad to be back. Glad to be doing what I like to do.
Yeah. Too bad we can't get paid a little bit more for what we do, what we like right. to do. But, you know, you never know. We may hit it big one of these days. Right. Anyhow, moving right along, we're going to talk about the different kind of, you know, there's a variety of different smaller waiters and bartenders and restaurant workers and hotel workers unions that the mob ended up taking control of. And I believe you mentioned that in Fear City, I think the documentary that Paul Castellano made some statements on tape about some of those unions. Isn't that right, Cam?
Yeah. There's some really interesting stuff about him not wanting Chicago to interfere in some of the business that was going on in New York. I mean, if you read between the lines, that's what he's talking about.
Yeah. Interesting. A little, just put up a little YouTube video, a little funny one about the which is better, the Chicago outfit or the New York Five Families. As always, I get a lot of action off of something like that. This guy named Ben Ellickson, my friend from up in Chicago, he made up a really funny little movie on that.
Oh, yeah.
It was hilarious, I thought.
The starch and the fabric softener.
Right. You got to find out what God he's really talking about with these guys standing out in front of the social club. Find that Chicago outfit or New York Five Families video on my YouTube channel. Anyhow, moving right along. When you mentioned about doing this story, and I kind of looked at a little bit about what was going on in Kansas City, there's been a lot going on in Chicago and union-wise. I mean, Chicago is a union town, and Kansas City was too in the 50s, a huge union town. And the mob historically is going to get into those unions, any of those unions they get into, and the waiters and bartenders, because mob guys like to get into clubs, is like a natural. Anywhere they're selling alcohol, anywhere there's alcohol, there's gambling, and there's, there's women, there's prostitution, there's all kinds of gray market things going on, and where there's alcohol being sold. And so, you know, the waiters and bartenders union is a natural, hotel workers and all that. In Kansas City, back in the 50s, we had a guy, he had a nightclub, and he also, I think he was a golf pro at one of the, out in the suburbs, not out in the county country club. So there was gambling going on out there, and he was getting machines. He was getting slot machines and putting them in throughout Jackson County. Jackson County would be like Kansas City, just takes up a little part of Jackson County. Jackson County, a lot of rural area and a lot of clubs and small towns out there that all had clubs in them. And so he was putting not poker machines. Back then it was just slot machines, you know, the old Frank Costello thing, put those slot machines throughout in all the joints that you could. And he was putting them out there, but he was not bringing the Kansas City family in on the action. So they warned him a couple of times, and he thought he was really well connected. He was real tight with the Jackson County Sheriff. He was actually, they made him a deputy, and he had this, I want to say it was a 49 like Packard or something. And he had a huge big siren mounted up on the fender of it. And he flaunted how he was a Jackson County deputy. You know, he was a deputy, and, you know, because he was paying off the sheriff, and the sheriff let him do that. So he was back over in the city after several warnings. He was meeting somebody or doing something in the city, and he was easy to spot because of that big Packard and that that siren up on the fender. I don't know if you've ever seen those in old movies.
Oh, yeah.
Got a big chrome siren up on the fender.
big bell siren.
Really. So as he leaves the business, he goes to get in his car, and I'll get to the waiter bartender part of this in just a second. He goes to get in his car, and a 49 or a 54, brand new car, pulled up. A guy jumps out and runs over to him as he slides into the car at your most vulnerable. When you first get in the car, you're kind of vulnerable, and starts shooting him and kills him right there on the street. And the car takes off and leaves. And the police find this brand new 49 or 54, I don't remember which, crashed back in an alley, like they must have lost it or something, trying to get away, because I don't think they intentionally just gave up this car. And when they got to it, they started looking at it, it had secret compartments in it for guns, had two or three secret compartments in it, just like the Chicago hit car.
Right, hit car.
Some of your guys found up in the Chicago PD found in the, I want to say the 70s maybe, and I don't remember who was driving it. There was a couple of guys driving it that was
right, Aldericio and the Chicago typewriter, Nicoletti.
Nicoletti, yeah. I think weren't they searching for some of the some of that
Maraglia, Charles Maraglia,
the Eminem murders, right?
Right.
So, anyhow, so they check on this car, of course, and it's registered to the local Waiters and Bartenders Union in Kansas City, down on 12th Street, to just like a crow name, but that place and that address. So they go and they check, and it's brand new car bought in St. Louis, registered in this crow name at the Waiters and Bartenders Union. So right. Any paperwork would have come there to that day. It's pretty slick. And I'm sure they got another one after that, although we never found another one after that. So, you know, that Waiters and Bartender Union, I'm sure it goes clear back when they first started organizing in any manner around the war. They probably didn't really get organized till after the war. I don't really remember in the 30s. I doubt if they were organized back in the 30s, but anyhow, we go back that far, and I know they do in Chicago. So tell us a little bit about Chicago. Another interesting little thing. I got an old file from a guy, a highway patrol file, and they were showing the picture of Paul Rica in that murder. For some reason, I could find no explanation as to why they were showing the picture of Paul Rica, but they were showing the picture of Paul Rica around. Go figure. Huh. So let's start talking about Chicago a little bit. I mean, that's they really had a death grip on that. I don't know about Kansas City and the mob's control over it here. But what about Chicago?
So, you know, the Waiters and Bartenders was founded years ago. And what really got it started was in the beginning, they wouldn't accept foreign-born speakers. They wouldn't accept anybody from outside of the country. And, you know, in the 1890s and 1910s, that just you weren't going to grow if you were not expecting restaurant workers who were from out of the country.
Yeah.
I mean, those were the jobs they were taking, especially Italians. So once they decided to do that, the union blew up. You have 150,000 members. By 1950s, you have 400,000 members. Now, that's a lot of money pouring in. 1928, there was some conflict, and the president of the union, the guy who was running for the president, was murdered at the local convention in New York. That's a bad look for any union.
Yeah.
One of the main things about the Restaurant Workers Union is they allowed international officers to interfere in the local unions. So the international officers could step down and they could get involved in the business of the locals, which is a lot of unions function that the local is a ship on the sea. It is on its own. It's they don't allow local officers to meddle in the businesses. And that would later play a major part in Chicago's ability to direct and involve themselves so deeply in what was going on with other unions and how they could sell positions and vice presidencies to other mobs around the country. So what really blew it up is after Prohibition ended, Frank Nitti was looking for ways to make up for that lost money. And he knew that if alcohol was coming back, the bartenders union would be coming back. That was just, and that just makes so much sense to me. That just really shows the way he was thinking. So Chicago had three of these locals. They were local 593, that was run by Accardo and a guy named John Lardino. Local 278 under Louis Rodino, that was Romano. That was Frank Nitti and Murray Humphreys' local. And the last one, the one that really blew up, was local 450. And Joey Iupa was the secretary. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you don't have to look too far to see where that one was mobbed up. He ran it, and in 1957, that's when Ed Hanley became the business agent of Local 454, and he became the anointed one for that union and eventually for the entire the hotel employee and restaurant employees international union, Hiryu.
I wonder what that stood for. Now, did they consolidated all the
small unions? Yeah, they basically ate them all up.
Yeah, I bet IUPA's people were all down in Cicero because he had clubs in Cicero, and that was his base. You think of Al Capone in Cicero, but when you get into more modern times, that Joey IUPA and Cicero were he ran Cicero. There's no doubt about that.
And you either join the National at the end of a pen or at the end of a gun. I mean, and there's plenty of examples of both. So I think that they went through, they absorbed all these little locals, they're smaller unions basically, and that just blew up. And like I said, by the 1950s, you got 400,000 members, and every new hotel that opened in Las Vegas or that opened up anywhere, you've got another 150, if it's a smaller place, to 2,000 members if it's a big casino.
Well, yeah, Las Vegas, and of course Chicago had their hooks into Las Vegas. Yeah. Matter of fact, that kid Frankie Bluestein that those policemen killed out there in the famous scene from Casino where they were following the guy and he jumps out and the movie indicates he had a ham sandwich and the policemen say he had a gun and they found a gun and his father was a mover and shaker in that waiters and bartenders union or hotel employees union. And he had a job, of course, in a hotel in being in that union. So, it looks like to me, like maybe Henley, I gave him the job of reaching outside of Chicago and bringing other local unions in because down in Kansas City, what I was able to learn was they merged some small locals here. Henley was the guy. They had to go to Henley at the International, and he appointed a guy named Michael Salerno as the president of the first, kind of merged overall all union. And then what's really interesting after that is see the mob influence, a guy named Baldoresio or Benny, we used to call him Benny Palmateri. He all of a sudden, out of the dust of opening this up by 1975, he is a secretary treasurer. And he's close to Savella. We used to watch him all the time. I mean, he had this job, but all he did all day, they had a game going downtown and a lot of people would park at meters. It was in the back of something called Reliable Legal Service. And it was a high stakes card game. And he would go out and plug the meters for people. Whenever they'd start running out of time, he'd run out and put money in the parking meter so the people wouldn't get tickets and then go back in, come back out. So he was always that guy, but he, and then he had access to their health and welfare, their pension funds and all that.
That's, dental plan.
Dental plans, selling them dental plans. There's so many scams that a mob can get into with labor union people. I always tried to figure out what the draw was for union people, how they, these kind of people, these checkered past and what the draw was, how they got so many people to vote for them to get it in. I think maybe they thought they would give them more power leverage against employers because these guys would resort to, off the books kind of stuff. They'd do the vandalism and all that. If they want an employer to do something.
And I think if you stack the membership with a lot of guys who are willing to make threats, I mean, you've got guys in the, you nominate guys in leadership positions who are other made guys as secretary and general treasurer and other made guys in leadership and you hold votes. And I mean, for all you tell people that these are secret election, but everybody knows that they're not. Everybody knows. You tell people, well, you sign your name to it so we can make sure it's legitimate and that you're a legitimate union member because we don't want any fixed elections. We don't want any dead people voting. So just you got to make sure you put your name, your initials, or you got to show your union card to vote. It's not hard to see where these guys out of fear would elect a guy like Provenzano or would elect a guy like some of the Chicago Al Pilato to be in the laborers union. Mm-hmm. So it really, I think that every aspect of it was fixed and they're really just taking advantage of these working guys. But on the flip side of it, they did use their power and they did use their influence in local government to push through some good, some good plans. And they did a lot of the local guys who were in the unions will say that, well, they looked after us, they took care of us. So,
yeah. Yeah. I got one of the listeners. I did a show on, Salerno, Vince Salerno was a union guy, had some kind of a laborers union. And I got hold of Ben and he told a story. I said, you know, you got to tell me that story and I'll put it out as kind of a supplement to that last show about, you know, he was a laborer in a laborers union and there was a mob connected guy that was his union rep. And he had some problem with the healthcare part of it with his family. And he went to the guy and the guy jumped on it and straightened it out right away. So, you know.
Yeah. 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 So, I mean, you get mixed accounts. I mean, the government didn't appreciate their presence, but I mean, some of these guys didn't seem to mind.
Yeah, really. So I see here, I pulled up a little bit of stuff and said, there was a, let me take a look at this. Kind of interesting.
I think we should get into is Ed Hanley was the brother-in-law of Frank Calabrese.
Oh yeah, that's right. The President's Commission,
side fact.
Yeah, the President's Commission on Organized Crime stated that here, which is at hotel employees, restaurant
employees, international
is one of the four most corrupt unions in the United States, and that's under this Ed Hanley. So, tell us a little more about Ed Hanley and his connection to the outfit up there. I didn't realize that he was blood related or by marriage related.
He was by marriage related to Frank Calabrese. He's the uncle of Frank Calabrese Jr. And you know, I've had little dealings with them and he said he was a great guy. The Irish side of the family was a lot of fun, but because of that stipulation, the international officers intervened in the locals, that required Ed Hanley to be the one to set up new locals or to anoint new presidents in other locals. So when you got a guy like Ralph Natale in Philadelphia, who would later become sort of the boss with Joey Merlino, he was the boss of Local 54 in Atlantic City before he went to prison. And that would have had to have been set up by a guy like Ed Hanley, who would have done so at the behest of Chicago. So there you've got a tie between the Philly mob when Angelo Bruno was still alive and the Chicago mob. Ed Hanley would have been responsible for a lot of the expansion in Las Vegas, because he became president in 1973. So you think about what was going on in Las Vegas and the casinos in the 70s, and he would have been the international president. So any sort of labor disputes going on with new hotel workers and any sort of new unions that had to be set up in either Las Vegas or after 1978 in Atlantic City would have had to have been established through Ed Hanley. And you think what a tremendous amount of power that would have given, not just Hanley, but because his local was 450, that's his home local, that all comes under Joey Iupa.
A lot of power inside those casinos too. And you
got
one guy you can go to and say, you know, what about this? What's going on here? What's going on there? A lot of our wiretaps here in Kansas City was Augusto reporting to Nick all the different rumors and gossip and you know, all the inside baseball about what was going on at the Stardust. So you got union people all over the place. Then, you know, and those owners, they can keep some labor peace by hiring certain people and putting them in the right position. So, it's really it was a powerful tool for the mob all during
You know,
from the 30s to the 80s, I guess. I what happened whenever they started changing over the corporate structures and everything? Did it kind of stay the same?
I think, you know, what you've got is you've still got the people in the unions, so it would be hard. I mean, even with the corporate structure, you've still got the guys in there who would be willing to lay down on them. Just like in Hollywood, there was the corporations in Hollywood in the 30s. You've still got guys who can lay down, who can, that was a way that and as much as they say that the corporations clean up Vegas and the corporations could very easily contract workers out. I mean, you have this huge labor force who could still exert a lot of influence and power on what was going on with whomever was running the casinos.
You know, I'd read something about this Ed Hanley, how as the corporations moved into a lot of these, instead of, you know, historically restaurants and hotels, even especially restaurants, were all little individually owned things. And then, you know, start getting franchises and even the hotels in Las Vegas, they were owned by individuals. Just these, they may have investors, but they'd have one strong individual that would run a hotel, and you'd only have to deal with that one personality. Now you got a corporate board. And right. So you got all these different unions in say a hotel. So Ed Hanley started merging those different trades, if you will. I don't know if you'd call it a trade, but you know, like waiters and bartenders, and then probably the casino girls, the
showgirls,
the you know, pit boss. I mean, not the pit bosses; they'd be management, but you know, the guys, the blackjack dealers, and all that. You would start merging them into one union in order, and it would be wise. It would be good union business to you know, if you make us mad here, we'll take everybody out because we've got hooks into everybody. We'll take everybody out.
There's an interesting example of that. They dissolved the International Production Services and Sales Employees Union in 1983. That was run by the Lucchese family in New York. A guy named Robert Rao, who was a Lucchese associate, and trade for that taken over. He was named an international vice president of Hiru, and his salary in 1984 dollars was $143,000. And that was he had an expense account also. But you can see where those trades come up when they absorb another union that was run by the Lucchese. That would have had to run through. In order to absorb a union, just like you said, Ed Hanley would have had to play a role in it. That would have had to have been a deal between Chicago and the Lucchese family in order for this guy to be named an international VP, because Chicago controlled it and controlled the leadership board. Ed Hanley would have had to name him, because this is the last of the old time union power structures. So Ed Hanley would have had to name this guy, or at least approve him, or at least the votes would have had to come through his approval to name this guy an international VP. And I like that kind of thing. You think about, this is a direct interaction as late as 1983 between Chicago, even though it doesn't say they shook hands and had a deal. You know that this would have had to have been some sort of dealings between the Lucchese family and the Chicago family. And I've got a couple other examples where you know, even caught on recording with Castellano talking about interactions through this union specifically, with Chicago and the other families.
Interesting that. And I tell you what, I talk to a guy every once in a while here locally, and it's always, I'm always kind of amazed about this network, this inner city network.
Yeah.
And a lot of it comes out of the penitentiary too. People go in and out of the penitentiary. And so you learn about, you know, somebody there, then you get out, and then they continue to keep up with each other after they get out, because you never know when you need somebody in another city. And they did that a lot all during this time, probably not so much now, but boy, back in the 70s and 80s, 90s, they were, you know, that was a lot of the connections. I mean, if you want something in another city, just ask around your mob buddies, and they're going to have somebody that, you know, they can trust for great, you know, more or less in another city. So that's, And, you know, Castellano, he's kind of an egomaniac. He did not like having to go to Chicago, I'll bet.
No, there's an example of a Colombo guy, Vito, and there were two locals in Chicago. One of them was responsible for the restaurants in clubs and hotels, and the other one was at a larger, Local 60. And that was a Colombo, and Local 100 was a Gambino. And both of those would have been established with Chicago. So Paul Castellano was telling this Colombo associate, Vito Pita, to stop making trouble. He was trying to poach members outside of what their responsibilities would have been. So they had to sit down. He said, you got to stop doing this. because he basically, Castellano was responsible to the, he keeps calling it the International. I'm the one that's responsible to the International. Mm-hmm. And when he's talking about the International, he's talking about Chicago. And I mean, and he says, there's quotes of him. He says, I said to Vito, take it easy. You know, I gotta watch, like, someone else owns the International. See, I don't like these doings. Someday they have a right, some things they have a right to do. In the meantime, the only reason they're doing it is because Vito is setting something up in my, I don't do that. I'm happy with the International, you know? They were happy about it, meaning Chicago, but Vito wasn't. I tell you what brought them over here, Chicago, I'm guessing, is this is my local and I don't want anybody to touch it. So if you read between the lines, yeah. There's a Colombo family fighting with a Gambino family at the local level. And you know that Chicago, Ed Hanley has say over the locals.
Yeah.
Chicago has say over Ed Hanley. I mean, that's just damned interesting. You've got Castellano talking through the line saying, look, I don't want them over here in my shit. And this little Colombo associate is blowing up my spot.
Yeah. You know? Don't bring on the heat from Chicago.
Exactly. They have a right to do it because it's their local, but man, yeah. I don't want them in my city.
Yeah. Really interesting. You know, and the terminology used when he said something about they own them, what was that terminology? That's the terminology they use. If someone else owns
the local.
Right. Right.
There's owns the International.
Where he said, who's he owned by? You know, Chicago owns him. Oh, okay. That's how he said that. Chicago owns him. So, and it was a guy that talked about some guy that was, you know, historically and in retrospect, we know now he was, you know, affiliated with the Chicago outfit more than anybody else. He was not even from there particularly, but he was, you know, affiliated with them. So, kind of like I always wondered who they thought owned Alan Glick in Las Vegas. I think it must have been Kansas City because Kansas City's the one that threatened him.
Yeah, Kansas City or Milwaukee would have dealt with him a lot. But yeah, somebody would have had their hooks in him. But Kansas City, you're right, it was the one that dealt with him directly.
They're the one that dealt with him directly. He dealt with, it's kind of interesting, you know, start about dealing with people in this business. You know, he dealt with Frank Ballesteri in Milwaukee first. And then when it came time for some kind of information to be passed back down to him, and he actually, I think he, they had a meeting in Chicago about it, and Chicago gave their approval of all this and being involved with all this, but never really met with him. Then Kansas City, when it comes time to have some kind of straightening out talk with him to come to Jesus meeting, Kansas City gets a job of doing that. So it was just kind of interesting how that works.
Right. Another one they had dealing with was Philadelphia. It was a guy, Ralph Natale. He tells this story about how Angelo Bruno and Carlo Gambino made him in a private ceremony, which is, you know, a lot of people say Ralph Natale said a lot of things and they said he was the boss. And yeah. He says that with. But what's interesting about his story is he said he met Joe Batters and, you know, he knew to call Accardo Joe Batters, and Chicago was responsible for making the local and Atlantic City. And they did make that deal with Gambino and with Angelo Bruno. So it's strange that he knew all this. He went to jail in 1979 after he was the president of Local 54, which would have put him in charge of the locals in Atlantic City. So there are aspects of truth about this story that's a little bit fantastical to believe, but there were meetings where Chicago met with Atlantic City and met with Bruno and met with the Gambinos. So we know that there was a lot of truth in the ballpark of what he was saying.
Yeah.
But when Atlantic City was set up, Ed Hanley played a role in that, which means Chicago did, even though Chicago was hands off, they had to help set up the locals. And, you know, there were 15,000 members when all was said and done in Local 54 in Philadelphia, which is a huge, huge union. I mean, that's a lot of people in that local. you know, that's all the bartenders, all the, every new casino was another 1500, 2000 Mets.
Yeah.
So yeah. And Chicago would have had to help them set up, even though they're hands off that city, that local would have had to sit and come through, through Chicago. And Gambino's basically owned the Bruno family. Mm-hmm. So that's another example of New York and Philadelphia dealing with Chicago.
Interesting. I guess a little bit like Hoffa and the Teamsters, and any local Teamster guy, he pretty well had to, you know, Roy Lee Williams pretty well had to get Hoffa's right. approval for anything they would do down here. He right. had a certain amount of leeway, I'm sure, and probably every other city did, whoever their kind of main Teamster was. But I bet everything they did had to be approved through Hoffa. You know, that's the ideal for the Bob, is to have one guy you can go to who can affect thousands and thousands of other people. So that's like ideal, you know, talk about economy of action or movement.
Yeah, exactly. But that's, I love reading those stories and those examples of when, you know, these guys in the 70s and 80s were talking to each other. I mean, we know that Luciano and Paul Rica, and that they all knew each other. But when you're getting into the 70s and you're getting into the 80s and these guys were talking and were dealing with each other, I mean, that's what really got me into being interested in the mob, is how are these cities relating to each other? How do they know each other? And the 70s and 80s were the time that things were blowing up. And that really I find the most interesting.
Yeah. And the unions were an integral part of that international Absolutely. Or national kind of crime that was going on. They were an integral part of that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Of course, that brings in the U.S. Department of Labor. Of course, they were always kind of a paper tiger. We had one labor investigator that was assigned to the strike force back in the early 70s. Now, by the time the skim trials were over, they knew more about the connection of the Teamsters and the Mafia than they ever wanted to know. As a matter of fact, they knew so much, they just totally made everybody resign, put it in receivership, and brought it back. Now, they never did that with the waiters and bartenders, hotel employees. Never did it. Never broke it up, did they?
You know what? In 1995, there was some there was a RICO statute brought against the entire union.
Oh, was it?
And at the same time, Hiro and the Department of Justice filed a consent decree to free Hiro and all its locals from the direct or indirect influence from organized crime now and in the future. So by 1995, they did decide to try and rid themselves, and they found that the organized crime was violating the members' Lanyard Griffin rights. So 1995 rolls around, which is really late. They did decide to try and step in and help these guys. But they even got into loaning money and everything in the 70s. I mean, it was all the regular rates, but yeah, I mean, Morris Schenker took the largest loan out from the Hiro and never paid it back, $6 million.
I need to do a whole in-depth look at him, man, that guy. And he blindly just made it right on through too. I had a little side story. I played golf with a guy who was originally from St. Louis. His dad had a gas station in an area called Forest Park. It was kind of a blue collar section, not too far from downtown. And so his dad was Irish, Fitzgerald. And he's going to run for city council or whatever, alderman or whatever they called it back in the 50s. And he loses. And so just bear with me, folks. I'm going to say a couple words here. But he says, you know, I'm an Irishman and I got beat by a Jew. How you figure that? It was Morris Schenker he was running against.
We know who had the mob behind him.
Yeah, we know who had those precincts wired up. See, that's how strong the mob can be. They can help Morris Schenker, a Jewish lawyer, win an election in an Irish ward, and it was against a guy named Fitzgerald. Right. Go figure that. You know, I was reading a little more about at the end of Henley's career. That it happened in that 1995, and he was getting old by then. Anyhow, they caught him setting up a fake local. he had a retirement, I mean, a retirement, a vacation home up in Wisconsin, like all those Chicago guys did. If they had money, they probably had another house up in Wisconsin to go to. And he set up a fake local, and they had one employee, and all that employee was supposed to do was do stuff to take care of things for Henley up around his house, his vacation home and all that. And I tell you what, he was, and he did. I read this also. Let me take a look at this. He negotiated an out-of-court settlement that gave him immunity from prosecution. Yeah. He did end up retiring from the union, but he remained on the board of trustees of their health and welfare pension fund until about the time he died, I think. That guy was powerful. Yeah. Well, he had a lot of really powerful political connections, the only thing I can figure.
Yeah, that's really all you can say, is that he's a difficult character to figure out, because you know that he was steeped in, and he knew all these mob guys, and you look back in the history and they say that he was this and he was that, but he kept himself out of prison, basically. He kept himself, so he was clean enough that he didn't get in trouble, and he sort of was able to protect himself in a lot of ways. So he's a really enigmatic sort of figure. How did he, when you look at a lot of these union guys like Roy Williams and Hoffa, and they all got in all this deep trouble for what looks on paper to be the exact same kind of stuff. I mean, how did Hanley skate? And I mean, I'm sure the Irish politician aspect of it doesn't hurt, but he really did get by with a lot of the stuff that it appears a lot of the other union guys were doing. And then, of course, in 2000, he had that terrible car crash that took him out.
Okay, I didn't remember that. And then especially being related to Frank Calabrese. I mean, you'd think the government would have been all over him. He was this powerful a union guy, and he's related to a really well-known, I wouldn't say powerful, but a well-known mob guy, outfit guy. That's right. Everybody knows the outfit guy. That's all that Calabrese whole family ever did. They were, they were steeped in the outfit. And so here their relative is ahead of this big union, this international or national union. And I would have thought the government, I don't know how he made this deal at the end. I'd be interested to know a little more about what deal he made. It was in the later 90s. So the outfit was kind of, they were on the downturn. Everybody had gone to prison for the skimming by then.
Yeah. Yeah. That was, the outfit all sort of crumbled as, I've talked to Paul Wickham, and he was part of that trial where they brought down Wings Carlisi and Gus Alex. But really, I don't know that Hanley wasn't a part of that, but it's really an interesting thing that he didn't go down. And I don't know to what extent he was involved with things, or he just sort of did what he was told and stayed out of the criminal aspect of it. But he's a really interesting guy.
Yeah, he is. All right. Well, Cam, this has been most interesting about the one of the labor union aspects of the outfit and the five families in Kansas City and other, every other major city, Cleveland. They all had waiters and bartenders and hotel employees and all ended up in this one union. Hereu, H-E-R-E-I, I guess. Definitely was controlled by the mob.
Right. It was one of the big four corrupt unions, they say. So it was up there.
But the laborers, the Teamsters?
Teamsters, Hereu and the dock workers.
International Longshoremen.
Longshoremen.
Yeah. That goes way back.
Oh, yeah.
It goes back to the old days. New Orleans and one of the early mob battles down there. After the turn of the century, was some dock workers that were mob guys coming up out of work and going back up into the city. And this wasn't wasn't out in the Gulf. This was on the Mississippi River, and a rival mob group, the Matranga group, attacked them and had a big shootout down there. So this goes way back. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Cam. I appreciate it. Don't forget, folks, look out for motorcycles. And if you think you might have any PTSD problems, you better check. And you're a veteran, better check with your VA and find their hotline. Anything you want to plug out there?
I've got my book that will be coming out very shortly. It's been at the publisher for a while. I wrote with Lisa Swan, who was the ex-wife of Frank Calabrese Jr., Married to the Mob and Other Misadventures. Mm-hmm. We turned it in a while ago, and the entire publishing industry has been behind quite a bit since COVID came out. So it is a little bit back from where it should be. But that should be coming out very soon, and we're both really excited about that.
Really, I look forward to that. You know, I interviewed Frank Calabrese Jr., and he didn't really talk about his wife. But he certainly was one interesting guy. He talked about talked about his dad was closely connected to this waiters and bartenders or hotel employees and restaurant employees guy. And so he said when he was a kid, he remembered they went to Vegas a lot as a family, and everything was carte blanche. I mean, everything. And I didn't really realize, I thought, well, maybe it was the mob connections, but it was the union connections. You would have mob and union connections, but they would really have it made in Las Vegas as a family when they went out there.
Oh yeah.
Interesting. Might be an interesting show just to talk to Frank about what he remembers about this Edward Hanley. That might be real interesting.
Absolutely.
Excuse me. Okay, Cam. Thanks a lot. We will do some more.
Take care, Gary.
All right. See you.